Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Unifowaken.
This week, April Fools on the web. Amazon snaps up Goodreads. Bitcoin breaks a $1 billion. The elusive Facebook phone may be on Android. A new iPhone gears up for production. And a special message from the president. But first, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And this last week, I went to WonderCon, which is like a mini version of Comic-Con that takes place every year in Anaheim at the Anaheim Convention Center. And one of the differences is WonderCon's more focused on keeping it real to the roots of comic book enthusiasts. And
Keeping it real.
Doesn't stretch out too much into the multimedia, like the film and TV thing. However,
I kind of love how, like, this incredibly urban phrase from my childhood, deep in the heart of Brooklyn, in some of the places that people would, you know, fear to tread, has become, like, as a geek, I'm going to keep it real. Yeah, like, it's just like, it's geeks are not mainstream. No. But it's just funny that, like, it's like geeks try to use that when they talk about, like, oh, I like anime, I'm all about Cowboy Bebop, I keep it real. And I'm like, wait, what?
Geeks can keep it real, too, can't
they? I've been stabbed by D-Snaps, people. Like, it's ridiculous.
Keeping it real goes wrong. Dave Chappelle knew what it's all about.
Exactly.
So while I was at WonderCon, I actually did cover the what little TV and film stuff there were, and I covered panels for the TV show Revolution, the Guillermo del Toro movie Pacific Rim coming up, and also James Wan's The Conjuring film, which is a horror movie. I covered those three panels. And also took a bunch of cosplay photos, all of which are on geeksofdoom.com.
Cosplay photos?
Oh, yeah.
How'd your lady feel about that?
Well, it's just people getting dressed up. It's not...
Okay.
It's no big deal. Cosplay, no big and the deal. Cosplay was, you know, gender mutual. It was both men and women dressed up. I got a great photo of a guy dressed up as a Ghostbuster. It was pretty cool. He had the full regalia. It was the booth was sponsored by the Bay Area Ghostbusters. Apparently Ghostbusters have chapters, regional chapters throughout the nation. Where
you're not a part of your local chapter of Ghostbusters?
I'm not
a
part of this.
Your geek cred is gone.
You know what? But I did get a card so I could join the SoCal Ghostbusters.
So I've actually met the New Hampshire Ghostbusters.
Oh yeah,
they always come for PAX East, and I think they've come for maybe a couple primes as well too.
Were you not part of the Amherst Ghostbusters?
You know what? I think that may have died out before my time.
Oh, no, it was there. You just didn't know. I went to the reunion in 2006.
Oh, wow. I must have missed that boat.
The other thing that I've been playing with this week is BioShock Infinite. And admittedly, I have not gotten far into it. I think I'm probably in the first, the third chapter in the game.
Are you on Windows or OS X?
Windows.
Windows?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Technically it's on my Mac Pro, but it's on the Windows boot camp
partition
yeah. that I'm playing it on. And I have to say, with the proviso that I'm really not that far into it, what I've played so far is phenomenal. The level of production design, the world that Irrational Games has built for this game is just incredibly immersive. And this is, see, when we talk about games, and we've talked about games on the show tons of times, this is really the epitome of what I appreciate about a game that puts you in a fantasy world and makes it so realistic that you're completely immersed in it. This is what I play games for, games like BioShock.
Wow, I just bought it on Amazon because of the way you were talking about it.
You know, I'm really actually impressed by what the developer's been able to produce, because typically when you find games like this which get epically delayed, they just usually bomb. And from what you've said and from everything else I've heard, it seems to be an amazing game with a perfect blend of you know, story and action.
These guys were delayed, too. They were delayed like 3 times before their release. And they finally were able to release, and it's getting like monster scores all over the place. Metacritic scores of 95 plus.
Now, have you played any of the previous games?
I played the original BioShock. I didn't play BioShock 2. BioShock 2 was actually developed.
Original BioShock, let's just get into that for a moment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Phenomenal.
Oh, like, absolutely.
Phenomenal cosmic power. Like Aladdin genie style. Like, it was the game to redefine a whole bunch of games. Not all games, but a whole, like, the first person shooter meets the Quake games meets Thief in terms of you gotta sneak some places, you gotta fight some places, this little girl's gonna kill you. Like, scary fucking shit. Wonderful fucking shit.
Yeah.
Pardon my language.
Yeah.
So I remember BioShock 2, I was like, okay, more of the same. I'm alright with this. I don't hate it. I don't have any like crazy negative things about it, but okay, it's a franchise, and at least the gameplay is going to persist. Well, it sounds like Infinite makes it all the weight worth it.
The problem with BioShock 2 is it was developed by a different developer than developed BioShock 1 and BioShock Infinite.
And that happens in it. That's what made Quake 4 so lazy feeling.
Right. And what's great about BioShock Infinite is instead of rehashing the whole world of Rapture again, they went in a completely different spin, a completely different environment, a different backstory, different characters, and yet the game mechanics are still familiar from the first BioShock. So it's like the same sort of game mechanics.
They pulled an ID Software.
Yeah.
They did.
Yeah, yeah.
Because ID Software created Doom.
Yep.
Then it created Quake.
Yep.
And Quake was like kind of like Doom.
Right.
And then it created Quake 2, which is a completely different world, but same mechanics. And it was Quake 3, which is a completely different world again, but pulling from the previous worlds, but similar mechanics. And then Quake 4 brought you back to Quake 2, and it's like, OMG. You just feel like you're just in this cycle of love, of gaming love.
So highly recommended.
Like, the biggest thing for me is that there's this stuff shows with this and the rebirth of StarCraft 2 in the Zerg release that came out recently. There's still room for PC games.
Absolutely.
Like there's this world that's like, oh no, it's all console. And I gotta say, I'll talk to the Avenger and be like, nah man, get into the console. And I'm like, I can't do it when I can sit in front of a keyboard and mouse and kick ass with complete control. You know?
Well,
like, I'm not gonna say I don't play the console games. I do. I love them. They're great. My PS3 and my Xbox 360, they get hammered out. But if I can sit in front of my machine, and the intimacy of your face so close to that screen as opposed to when you're on TV, you know, like I'm playing the game at 1920x1200, yada yada yada. There's something to that, and I don't think that's gonna be lost. Very soon.
For
it may
sure.
be lost eventually, but it won't be lost very
soon.
Yeah,
I think it's going to last a long time. Also, graphically, too. You see beautiful games like Tomb Raider, the Tomb Raider that came out this year.
Tomb Raider? Yeah.
Yeah, if you've seen some shots from that running on PC at high level, it's just – it's really crazy to think how far we've come. One of my friends linked me a very high-res image, and I can link that to you guys. But then I also was like – hey, I wonder, I remember when I first played Tomb Raider, let's go find an image of Lara Croft from back then. And right. It's just like two
640
blocks.
640 by 480, like, yeah. Like each breast is a triangle. Like,
and at the time we were like, man, she's sexy.
Yeah.
Well, it just goes to show, I mean, obviously our standards have upgraded. I mean, when it comes to, we had that period of convergence where what was on the computer was not as powerful as what was on the TV. The computer leapfrogged the TV. The TV tried to hit with 720, like, you know, 480, and then 720, and then 1080. And now we're only just moving to the 4K and 8K stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that the microprocessor revolution, the idea that your TV has a microprocessor in it, the idea that your laptop has a microprocessor and two separate distinct video cards in it, has gotten us to this point where we can be pleased without, and we can feel like we're experiencing new things without necessarily feeling as if we have to go through hoops to get there. And that's what's exciting. Like when you're watching Netflix in HD on your 1080p screen, you're like, wow, okay. And when you're playing a game that's like, you know, 1080p or higher, because you're on like, maybe you're on a cinema display or one of the Dell super high end displays, you're like, that's what's up. And it's great to be able to experience that level of immersion. I think that's what Andy's really talking about, being immersed in these games. It's great to experience that level of immersion without thinking necessarily that why is it so impossible, because it's possible. And I think that's what I'm excited about with the PS4 and the next Xbox.
Yeah, and I'll be seeing those at E3 this year later on. Dwayne, how about yourself? What have you been playing with this week?
I've been playing with the Drobo 5D. I bought the 5N, I played with it, and then I got rid of it, and I got the 5D. I'm a guy who has a lot of data. I've got a terabyte of just pictures between me and my girlfriend over the last 5.5 years of being together. We've amassed pictures, and that's what I, you know, like we were using Picasa for a while on our Windows boxes. Then we moved to OS X, and we started using iPhoto, and there's a terabyte of photos. There's videos from snowboarding. I sent you guys a couple videos from some of the footage that we took when we last like went out with a big group when we snowboarded. You guys saw that. We take a lot of video, and it gets distilled into produced, fun, music flowing, like here's a group of us and here's us having fun, stuff like that. So that takes up a whole bunch of terabytes. But then you have little clips that you want to keep around. And then I've got, you know, my DVD and Blu-ray collection, which I have converted into digital storage. And that also sits there. So I got the Drobo. I've been using JBOD style, just a bunch of drives. And I moved to the Drobo 5D because I was actually more, I felt more safe with just a bunch of drives and replacing them as needed than I ever felt with the original Drobo devices and the Synology devices that were out there. There was this idea with Synology that, yeah, it was stable, but it was network and it was really focused on Windows. And then there was this idea that with Drobo, like, it was cool and, like, it would work on OS X, but if it failed, you were totally screwed. And why did it fail? Because power went out, because of whatever. And they fixed some of these problems. The new Drobo 5D that I'm running has a built-in battery backup, and that battery makes it so that if power should fail, it's going to back up. It's not going to back. The write caching is going to finish before the write caching will finish before it ends up, you know, losing all of its power. And that means that I'm not going to lose any data. And that's the kind of thing I was looking for. So I've obviously got it plugged into UPS. So it's got, you know, however many minutes comes with the UPS on top of whatever it needs. But the idea is that, you know, the UPS might get hit by a power strike and it's not going to go zappy. If there is a power failure, the Mac that the Drobo is connected to is also on the UPS. It's connected via USB. The Mac will know that it needs to shut down and the Drobo will shut down fine. But if that doesn't happen, the Drobo will still do the right caching thing and connect. The Drobo has one more thing that I really like, and that's the mSATA card. So in addition to the whole Beyond RAID thing, I don't know if you guys know about that, but basically I can throw whatever drives I want. I've got three terabyte drives and two terabyte drives, all SATA 3, in there for about 6 1/3 terabytes of data. And I've got maybe 3 terabytes of it taken up. but I can replace those two terabyte drives or any of the drives when the 4 terabyte drives come out, and I can throw them in there, and boom, I'm good. Jobo does a good job of telling me what drives are compatible. I'm using my 3 terabyte drives are red drives, which are meant for the Jobo directly. My 2 terabyte drives are green drives, which are compatible but not meant for it directly. I expect those to fail first. If they do, I'm going to be ready. I have dual disk redundancy, so 2 drives can fail before I do anything about things.
Right.
I can go away for a weekend and not worry about it, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. I feel like I'm in good shape. I have all this data that really matters to me. I've gotten my girlfriend into all these things like the BBC Blu-rays of Doctor Who, Torchwood, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all just sitting there ready for her to get access to through my Apple TV and my Jobo. So the more I can get my girlfriend to appreciate geeky shit, the better my life is. Right? Like, the more I can get her to be like, oh, I just saw that Age of Empires HD like trailer, and that was really cool, the easier it is for me to play Age of Empires HD.
Nice.
The more I can get her to understand Kerrigan and why she means so much to the gaming community, the more I can play the new StarCraft II expansion.
Uh-huh.
So, like, this stuff matters to me because it makes my life that much less dramatic when it comes to, like, girls.
Well, that's really all that matters, ultimately.
Exactly. There are girls, which every guy cares about, and there's geek, which I care about. If I could marry the two,
right?
No pun intended, Gina, then I'm in good shape.
Tosin, how about yourself? What have you been playing with this week?
So I've actually been playing SimCity. Surprise, surprise.
The new one.
The newest SimCity.
The one with all the problems that we talked about last couple weeks ago.
Yeah, no, definitely that one. And interestingly enough, I haven't had any – I started playing on Saturday, and I haven't had any problems logging in. I've always been able to log in, and I'm using one of the North America servers. So I think they may have smoothed out a lot of the issues. Now, as far as the game goes, really what SimCity is, it's really more of an MMO now, because I've been playing with a bunch of friends in a region. And the way it works is you can have several cities in the region, and they will share – they'll basically share the wealth as well as share the problems that occur in the region.
Mm-hmm.
There are some quirks to it that I can definitely see why people do not like. For example, having a limited map area, and limited city size that you can build in. And so if you are not very precise in how you build, you're going to run into a lot of issues. And still, usually in the old SimCities, you could expand a lot larger, and there is no such there is no way to expand here. So I definitely have that complaint, and there are a lot of bugs which you run into while you play SimCity. So for example, you can have trolleys that if you build a route which allows them to go in several directions, they can get stuck in a path of going back and forth. For a while, police cars wouldn't try and avoid traffic. They would just sit in them. Same thing with fire trucks, even when there was emergencies to run through.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of little nuances. And there are a lot of nuances that you don't know about. So, for example, I had built a whole bus line, and I realized at a point that people would only hop on spots which were on their side of the road. So if you were just putting spots on one side of the road, people will not cross the street to take a bus. It has
to
alternate. Yeah. I mean, but I guess isn't that kind of how it is in real life? Sort of?
Depending on where you are. If you're in Boulder, for instance, and you're taking the CU hop, you can hop on either side of the street and you'll get the CU.
Yeah. So little nuances like that. And I would have to say, as far as enjoyability, I think these issues would be a larger scope if I had paid full price for the game. I lucked out and managed to get a very nice discount on it.
Oh, nice.
So without that, I would probably not be too happy. But in terms of just pure gameplay and pure fun and addiction, it is top notch. I've been playing with currently 3 other friends, and the group seems to constantly be expanding. But it's really fun to work with each other to try and accomplish several of the set goals, to, you know, realize, hey, I need more police, and ask my friend, hey, if you could send over a trooper, and I'll send something your way. It's surprisingly addictive. And that's coming from someone who usually doesn't get to play very many games and usually is spending that time doing other things. I've just been so unraveled that, you know, if I wasn't podcasting right now, I would be in SimCity. So I think once they really smooth out all the additional issues, concerns with it, I think a lot of people are going to have a great time with it.
Oh, awesome. Awesome. Well, that's good to hear. And I really would love to play it. And I... although that's one that I feel like I'm going to wait until they do the OS X conversion, because I know that that's coming.
Yep, yep.
Get it natively on my OS X.
Yeah, definitely. It won't hurt to wait for the game. It's not like it's going away.
Right.
And it's not the type of game like the old SimCities where you could build in one city for, you know, months at a time,
mm-hmm.
because you're limited in space. There's only so much you can do before you choose to really move to another open area. But I really consider it more of an MMO than anything. It's not a solo act. It's something that you're really going to want to play with a group of friends.
Oh, that's good to know. Because part of the one of the, you know, contentions that we'd been talking about a couple weeks ago was that, you know, they sort of hacked it so that you actually could play it on your own if you wanted to. But you're saying that it's really well suited to network with other people.
Right. Just because of how things are shared and how you're usually working towards a corporate goal. So, for example, in my region, my city actually deals with education. So a lot of the citizens from my friend's cities come to mind for university, high school, and so forth. They only keep community colleges in their current locations. But then I send a lot of my citizens there for job opportunities and for tourism. We have a specific city which is coming up right now, which is purely tourism. So it's really – the dynamic is very cool.
Cool. All right. Let's get into some of our headlines this week. This last week was April Fool's Day, otherwise known as the day you can't trust any news report on the internet. Whether you love it or loathe it, April Fool's is inescapable. Let's take a look at some of the 2013's clever cons. Google is always good for an April prank or three, and the company had a few different takes on April Fool's this year, such as Google Knows, which is their attempt to bring scent to search, whereby a range of expertly curated knowledge panels pair images, descriptions, and aromas, as well as links to what people also sniffed. Pretty funny, Google. Also, you guys were talking about before Gmail Blue, which was Google's email team facing the challenge of how do we completely redesign and recreate something while keeping it exactly the same. The result is a whole lot of blue, literally. Blue text, blue pictures, blue everything. And, Dwayne, when you sent me a link to this earlier in the week, I mentioned that there might be a subtle dig in there at Windows 8.1, which was formerly codenamed Blue until this week, because they had some interesting sort of lines in there, like, we are faced with the challenge, how do we completely redesign and create something while keeping it exactly the same? And the other line that struck me was, I think the first thought that's going to come to the end user's mind is that I can't believe I waited this long for this.
Yeah, I found that that was my favorite line. I think people are gonna, like, when the guy at the end says, I think people are going to think, how could I have waited so long for this? To me, the thing that made this the most funny was the resonance. Like, so things are not funny unless they are true.
Mm-hmm.
It's as simple as that. You can't be a comedian and tell a joke and have people laugh. It's a completely fake story. It's got to have a kernel of truth in it that makes people resonance in people's lives and they giggle at it. Google is telling a story about blue and how everything's blue. And so when you watch this video, everything from the white woman saying that, hey, you know, we tried brown and brown was a disaster, that makes you giggle because you can imagine how much of a disaster that would have been if they tried to go brown. To the guy at the end saying, I can't, but people are going to say, I can't believe I waited this long, when there's nothing new about it. It's a theme.
Right.
It's just brilliant. It's like you're looking at something that, that completely describes how the technosphere views incremental updates or car fascia refreshes or whatever. And I think what it shows is that Google can lampoon themselves.
Yeah.
Like how Justin Timberlake often lampoons himself on Saturday Night Live. You're able to say, well, he makes fun of himself.
Yeah.
So he doesn't take himself that seriously, which makes him almost cooler than he was before. Like, I didn't give a shit about Justin Timberlake until he showed up on Saturday Night Live. Meanwhile, my girlfriend's got pictures of him when she's a 14-year-old, you know, on her wall, and pictures of him when she was his groupie back when she was, like, 16. So, like, the idea that that they're able to lampoon themselves, make fun of themselves, and show how tech companies are trying to constantly reinvent the same paradigm to users in a very overt marketing fashion is new and interesting, and it makes me laugh because Gmail Blue is exactly what anyone who's been looking at the current the default Gmail would want, oddly enough, yet no different than what it is, and that is the success of a hit. Go ahead, Tilson.
I think if I'm remembering correctly, I think someone actually built that plugin overnight.
Did they?
Yeah, that they noticed that. I'll have to dig up a link, but I'm pretty sure this was one of the items that someone actually built a plugin for it because it was just so hilarious. And it's just, it's, you know, I think sometimes the best pranks or jokes are the simplest ones.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
That was, you know, they. Google went to all ends making the videos for some of their other ones, like
yeah.
Maps and a few others.
Mm-hmm.
And this was more on the simple side, and it was just so perfect, so elegant, and really cracked me up.
Maps was they did this whole video about how they had discovered these lost treasure maps, and now they're incorporating them into Google Maps so that people can find the treasure for themselves. And you had to do things like hold your laptop up to the sun or fly over the area so it matches exactly in order to find certain landmarks. That's pretty funny. What am I
–
I think – oh, yeah, go
ahead.
I would
say, like, before you go on, I was just going to say that what Google has done is they've taken April Fool's Day, which is not a holiday at all.
Yeah.
And they've made it something akin to – they've made it something to look forward to. We've had these years where everyone will agree that, you know, Valentine's Day is a Hallmark holiday or whatever. April Fool's Day has become significantly and unequivocally a Google holiday. Right?
Well, like, Google so and is, other,
yeah,
yes.
It's like Groundhog's Day, you know?
Sure. Call it whatever you want.
It became its own thing.
Well, I mean, the Groundhog Day was a big thing before the movie, but I would say that what Google has done is they've taken this, like, silly today, and they've made it something to look forward to. You know, at the end of March,
yeah,
you're like, there's going to be some funny shit for April Fool's Day. What are they going to do this year?
Right.
It's more than it's more than typical marketing. It's magnetic. You want to go on. You want to find what's up, and Google wants to mess with you, and they're having a banter with their users, which is a big deal considering what they get out of their users and what the skepticism is in the media about what Google's users are. To the media, Google's users are just a way for them to get more data to sell the advertisers. It's all about the advertisers. But when Google does these sorts of things and the people behind Google are able to communicate with the people who use Google to convey a level of humanity, hilarity, sympathy, whatever – you feel – this is the reason why like you want to use Google. Obviously, the search results are good. But you're going there magnetically because you know it's going to be funny with YouTube, with Maps, with Google Knows, with whatever, right? Like, you know it's mm-hmm. something that's going to be funny, and you know that you want to be a part of that or know that or whatever. And that happens more often than we think. April Fool's is the apex, but there's the Google Doodles that happen with their games or something else, and you go there because you want to. And to be honest, Microsoft can work as hard as they want to make Bing a decision engine or whatever they want to market it mm-hmm. as. But without this level of intimacy with the user, they will never break that 30%. Simple as that. It's a gimmick, mm-hmm. but it works.
Did you see YouTube's prank?
YouTube, another Google prank.
Right.
Let's call it what it is. YouTube did a very wonderful thing. It's a very good prank. I think it was their first really big prank.
Yeah.
Highly produced. Well done. I don't want to go into what it was because I think people should go look for it. Look for YouTube contest on Google or whatever search engine you prefer, and you'll see the video. But I think it was well produced and wonderful, and it made me, again, appreciate what Google's culture is about. You want to be a part of that. And having a girlfriend who used to work at Google but doesn't any longer, and having a couple friends who do work at Google, and knowing what it takes for them to do the kind of crazy things they do on the web, and I'm talking programming, not videos. It's interesting to see that this is how they want to move it. The YouTube video is funny, and it's good.
Yeah.
But I think Tosin would agree that Gmail Blue was funnier because of how simple and silly it was, as opposed to the sort of like hijinks associated with YouTube. Now, YouTube did a great job in terms of finding previous YouTube stars. You know, mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's more realism, right?
Hide your kids, hide your wife. David yeah. goes to dentist or
yeah.
whatever.
Yeah.
Like they went out and they found everybody associated with YouTube success, and they made them a part of YouTube.
Yeah.
And that is something that I feel makes YouTube feel more close to home.
Right.
A YouTube celebrity doesn't need to be someone like Tia to whatever. I forgot her last name. that is trying to just like show themselves off.
Uh-huh.
But it's really like it's organic. It's literally organic. It's magnetic. 7 million people like this video. Why? Because it really mattered to them that this kid came out of the dentistry and was completely drugged. And that was not okay. But we all got it and we loved it. And then here, years later, he's a little bit more grown up and he's like, yeah.
Right.
Right? Like, I don't have to go into it to tell you that it's just worth seeing. If YouTube had only made those little links available uh-huh. in the video, in addition to the little hat that comes down that says, you know, Happy April Fool's Day, the little links, whenever someone showed up that was part of a big YouTube video success before,
mm-hmm.
that would have helped it just a little bit more. Just got to have a little bit incremental growth on those videos, because those videos truly are what makes YouTube amazing. We didn't know how cool we were as a dumb, stupid society until YouTube showed up and showed us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Also, carrying on with the other pranks, Twitter announced that they were going to charge you for vowels. So they would demand $5 a month if you wanted to include A, E, I, O, or U in any of your messages. Why would remain free? Speaking of people who dominate, who have traditionally dominated.
Well, can I say something
about the
Twitter thing? Yeah, yeah. Given Twitter's last 12 months, that was less funny because it was possibly true.
Right.
That's all I'm going to say.
Yeah. The one thing I thought about the Twitter thing is, maybe they shouldn't be joking like this. I heard about that.
Yeah.
But you were talking about how Google seems to have dominated April Fool's. And another company that has dominated April Fool's, and we've come to expect great things from them traditionally, is ThinkGeek. And this year, ThinkGeek published their yearly list of April Fool's Day products, which include things such as the Play-Doh 3D printer, a kid's toy that runs from an iPad app and can create up to 5-inch cube 3D models. Let's see what else they did. The Creeper plush from Minecraft, a creeper that you can sleep with as a body pillow. I'm looking at some of the other things here. Aliens chestburster in a can, the Eye of Sauron desk lamp, the Death
that
Star.
That desk lamp was hilarious.
Yes. Bane walkie-talkies. And the best thing about this is that they started a tradition like the second or third year that they started doing this where they'll let people vote on these products, and the ones that get the most votes, they'll actually put into production.
And I have some of these things. I have the Darth Vader ice cube helmet tray.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I have someone sent me the USB squirming tentacle.
I have the 8-bit clip-on tie, which I think was the very first one of these that they actually put in production from a April Fool's prank.
Yeah, it's actually pretty remarkable how they started off just as a prank, and there were so many people who were like, well, I'd actually buy that.
Yeah.
And then they decided that, well, might as well.
Well, so. I feel like as if April Fool's Day is their second Christmas.
Yeah.
Right? Like, yeah. If holiday is where retail makes its money, April Fool's Day is where the web can get geeky and get those guys excited about things.
Okay. Moving on. This week was also the season premiere of Game of Thrones. And with 1 million downloads on BitTorrent in less than a day, the season premiere broke records on multiple fronts. Never before has there been a torrent that with so many people sharing a file at the same time. More than 160,000 simultaneous peers. Data gathered by Torrent Freak further shows that Australia has the highest piracy rate of the popular downloaded destinations.
That's because they're in the middle of nowhere or the end of nowhere. And they're like, I just want to be part of the Western world.
Not only that, but they also seem to have the most restrictive rules in the free world about data sharing. Remember they had that they were really, the government was really cracking down on data sharing for some time.
Yeah, that's true.
And London tops the list of pirate cities, but according to HBO, piracy isn't killing the show, quite the contrary. While HBO would prefer if everyone paid for Game of Thrones, their programming president Michael Lombardo doesn't fear piracy. He sees it as a compliment and doesn't believe it negatively impacts DVD sales, which
people
apparently
are still okay, let's look at that economically as the business guy on the show. I think what they've begun to realize is that the people who are pirating the show would never pay for the show. Whereas Hollywood thinks to themselves, "Oh my god, I'm losing all this money because these people will be paying for the show and it costs this many dollars to watch it and voila, I'm losing all this money." They're like, the people who are part of the show have never paid for the show, will never pay for the show, and frankly, the show is meant for geeky people that have always found ways of not paying for shows. Therefore, we have to look at it from a popularity standpoint and just realize that what we're making works and that the people who are not these super geeks are going to pay, they're going to continue to pay. It's almost that there's an index for understanding how popular a show is based on how it's torrented. And then managing your advertiser's expectations. Sorry. Expectations based on that invoice. But you don't have advertisers if you're HBO. You're just HBO. Yeah. So you're like, I'm going to manage my shareholders' expectations.
I'm going to disagree with you just a little bit because I would say that watching the show in advance and seeing it, like, I will admit that I did not pay for watching Game of Thrones the first season that it was on, but watching it and seeing how good it was compelled me to want to get the Blu-ray box set when it came out after the first season. So it was a compelling, there was valuation in getting it in advance because it made me want to buy it when it finally came out on Blu-ray.
I think it also shows, I don't know if you're completely disagreeing with me, but
and I know
for
I'm
me,
not an
I would
outlier
say that it
that.
Shows that HBO, which is currently thinking about moving toward an open Go experience, meaning an experience that allows people who are not HBO subscribers via traditional cable channels to pay for HBO.
Yeah.
Can now look at the audience of people who are not HBO subscribers to normal cable and say, you know, I wonder how these people would deal for $15.
Yeah.
A month.
Yeah, yeah.
Or $20 or $30 a month, whatever it would be. I wonder if I can make my money out of them. And there's a lot of evidence that shows these people would say, you know what, I might come and go from Netflix, but I'll stay with HBO. And that might be a sea change.
I would
leaving
definitely
the cable companies to become the dumb parts that they've been afraid to become.
Yes, yes. Yes. And we know they're gonna fight back against that also. I'm a little scared about how they're going to do that. But that's a different conversation for a different time. Last week was also the 2013 Game Developers Conference, where the top gaming publishers convened to swap information and new tech. This year's highlights included an incredible new facial rendering technology by Activision. I don't know if you saw this.
Yes, amazing.
Yes. I mean, especially considering it's rendered in real time, it's also pretty creepy, like approaching the what's known as the Uncanny Valley. You guys are familiar with the Uncanny Valley concept.
Yeah. Why don't you explain what the Uncanny Valley is for any listeners who don't know?
So this was created by a guy who is the concept of the Uncanny Valley was formulated by a guy who is a Japanese researcher who is working in robotic research, creating, you know, robotic simulacrum. And basically he realized that the closer that a simulation looks to actual human life, the more we notice the things that don't quite match up. The more we notice the differences, and the more we feel creeped out by those differences. And so this demo demonstrates some. I mean, it's incredibly realistic. The movement, the facial movement, is so incredibly realistic. The speculation of, you know, there's this sort of like beneath the skin glow that happens. And then you see little details like the sort of the frame mapping stops. I mean, the texture mapping stops just inside the lips, and you notice that. And that's where you start to get creeped out, because it looks, everything looks so realistic that you notice what doesn't look realistic. And that's the Uncanny Valley phenomenon. Plus, also, there was a jaw-dropping 15-minute preview of Battlefield 4. I don't know if you guys took a look at this.
Yeah, 17 minutes.
17 minutes. EA released of Battlefield 4. It looks just incredible. Also, some great facial animation in that as well. It looks to be like a hardware pushing title. EA won't confirm it, but it looks like that it may be released on. They may be waiting for the PS4 or the Xbox 720 to release that on. It's been confirmed for current gen systems as well as the Windows. So the video that they showed is likely from a high end PC. Also revealed at GDC, the Android-powered $99 Ouya game console becomes available at retail on June 4th. Ouya is calling June 4th its official launch date, despite the fact that Kickstarter backers are going to start receiving units starting this month. Essentially, the two-month waiting period between Kickstarter boxes and retail availability is being used as a consumer beta, giving Ouya enough time to adjust its software after getting feedback from early adopters. I've seen...
And it's beautiful.
It's gorgeous. It's a tiny little
thing.
Maybe about the size of a fist.
If you have a free HDMI port on your television set, you are going to be happy. I am so sad that I did not buy a second controller, cuz I am going to be playing Angry Birds with my girlfriend. I'm like, nobody's business.
Did you see? Now let me
I'm
ask you.
Skeptical. Okay. I'm still skeptical.
And I'm
Yeah, you can be. But Tosin, you know that if any game runs on Ouya, fine. It's Angry Birds.
Angry Birds.
Well, that is what you want to be playing.
I'm saying Angry Birds is the Netflix. Angry Birds is to game consoles as Netflix is to any other piece of hardware that ever existed. You just know it's going to show up and it's going to work okay.
By the way, Netflix may end up showing up on the Ouya as well. So
that's because that's what it does.
Right.
It's a virus. You can't escape Netflix. Like, but, I'm in a console. I need Netflix on it.
But
I have a monitor. I need Netflix on it. I have a shoe. It needs Netflix on it.
Let me spin off Tosin's concern a little bit here, because you mentioned you were a little skeptical, and I just started hearing a little sort of murmurs over at Destructoid. They released sort of they had a
wasn't Destructoid. I was murmuring. Sorry.
But they're talking about the launch titles on the Ouya. And they seem that their criticism was the launch titles feel a little weak, and we know that it's capable of that. There's a lot of capable developers.
Andy, before you go on, how much does the Ouya cost?
$99.
How much does the Wii cost?
I don't know. Was it $199 or $299?
It was about $100, $200 at like its median. But it was $300 when it first showed up.
Yeah.
And then the PS3 costs $500, and the Xbox costs around $400 to $300 to $200 over its timeline, last 7 years. So at $99, I think you should shut the fuck up.
Okay, but as a backer, I'm a little concerned that the Ouya will not gain an adoption if they don't have some strong games at launch.
Right, because then it just becomes another handheld. I mean, although it's not a handheld in concept, it's supposed to be more of a console. It becomes a handheld in functionality. And then everyone else has...
I think the Ouya is going to carve out, possibly in its first, in its initial run.
Yeah.
It may carve out what we see as a slightly new niche that sits between casual gaming and hardcore gaming. The niche that Nintendo took up with the Wii, that Nintendo will probably lose with the Wii U.
I think it fits
somewhere in there.
My guess is that between now, when they're starting to ship Kickstarter units, and June 4th, when they have their retail launch date, that they'll probably get a lot more of those developers their ducks in a row and have some better launch titles, or better titles, upcoming launch titles. I know that the guy who did the Double Fine Adventure guys, I know that they've got exclusive Ouya launch title coming up. And that might be the killer app for the Ouya. All right, let's see.
Oh, Andy, why did you curse them with that title? Killer app. Stop.
The end is nigh.
Let's take a moment to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the audiobook I want to talk about this week is Doctor Who Tales from the TARDIS, Volume 1. And this came to me because this week was the mid-season premiere of another episode of Doctor Who.
Say Doctor Who before is the greatest TV show since Buffy the Vampire Slayer. I just want to say that out loud so people know that that's how I feel.
I personally love Doctor Who, even more than Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And I know,
I know that's
a little sacrilege there.
Whoa.
But you know, this last episode, the Bells of St. Joan, I thought was fantastic. I thought it was a really strong episode. I mean, you had a sequence here
I should be careful not to spoil it.
There's some great action in this.
Whoa!
That's all.
Had a great scene here that was so amazing that you should really look at it yourselves when you go to Doctor Who. But what we're talking about is the Audible book, Tales of the TARDIS.
Yes. So this book is 12 stories of excitement, adventure in distant time and places, read by such voices as John Pertwee, Peter Davison, and Colin Baker, the 3rd, 5th, and 6th Doctors, respectively. It's a beautiful, engaging collection of short stories narrated by the actual actors playing the various Doctors over the years. It's just a nice little sort of short story collection to get people started and hooked into the Doctor. And once again, read by the actual Doctors. I mean, come on. It doesn't get better than that. So that or any of Audible's other 100,000-plus titles can be yours for a free trial. Even if you don't like the Audible service, you get to keep the book for free. All you have to do is to take advantage of this deal is go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. Going to that URL helps us out on the show, so please help us out. Help a brother out. Help us help you.
Or three brothers out. Or four. Many brothers. Tosin and I are actually black people,
yes.
So it's really brothers that you're helping out. And Andy is ambiguous, so you just don't know. You could be helping a brother out. You could not. It's like playing the games.
I feel like I'm a brother in spirit.
Yeah, and we keep it real.
Yeah. Damn right. Okay, so we're going to take a little break here and listen to some music. And when we return, Bitcoin breaks a billion-dollar record, yet its creator still remains a mystery. Take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Duane DeFreitas and Tosin Onofuwakin. Amazon last Thursday said it will buy Goodreads, a social site that discusses and recommends books. In a statement, Amazon positioned Goodreads as an acquisition that it would pair up with its Kindle platform. Amazon added that it'll, quote, build many new ways to delight readers and authors alike. The melding of Goodreads' social approach with the Kindle could be enticing to avid readers. I think this seems like a very natural sort of fit for the Kindle.
Guys, Goodreads is that story that everybody wants to be. Started in the living room of a household with a man and his wife, and his wife and her husband, and they were like, I want to share the way that I feel about books. And they started it, and they put their own money into it, and they got it done, and it was bootstrapped. And now they have 16 million users, I think something like 10 million of which are active. They didn't do a whole lot of advertising. They didn't spend a whole lot of money on AdWords compared to so many other sources. They just sat there and they figured out that people who like each other might like the same books. They were focused on this in the same way that Flickster, the original Facebook app, was focused. But they managed to do it outside of another social network, build their own network, which was not crazy popular. But popular enough for Amazon to sit back and say, if I don't buy this, someone else will. And that's really what it takes from an entrepreneurial perspective in order to get what you need. And I'm hoping – I mean, it's an undisclosed amount of money. I'm hoping these people got like $20 million or $5 million. Who knows? It's just better than whatever they were making with Goodreads because there weren't a lot of ads on – or even like real revenue stream on it. And I'm impressed and I'm happy, and I think that Amazon is the perfect fit for taking in this clientele and leveraging it properly via their situation.
I like Goodreads. I feel like Goodreads is basically like a online social book club, or maybe
it's like Untapped for books.
Or I was gonna say GDGT for books.
Right. Okay, that works too. GDGT, Untapped, these things that allow people who are specifically into certain aspects of our world, books, technology, GDGT, beer with Untapped, to be able to quantify and lay out and record and approach this idea from the idea of the quantified self. Yeah. That's what's so cool about it. It's just like it's easy. Your friends like it. You didn't. That's cool. They're not going to hate you. There's no real forum to yell at people. Yada, yada, yada. It's just laid back and good, and I love that.
I hope they don't lock it off to just Kindle users. I hope they still keep it open to other book users as well. I mean, other e-device users as well.
You know? Yeah, me too.
Because they built this community, and the community came before the Amazon purchase. Okay, moving on here. Bitcoin, the world's first open source cryptographic currency, which has been on a tear since the beginning of the year, set a new record on March 28 when the price listed on the largest online exchange rose past $95 US. With nearly 11 million bitcoins in circulation, this sets the total worth of the currency at just over $1 billion. For a bit of perspective, that's how much Facebook spent on its acquisition of Instagram last April. But Bitcoin is not a company. It's a digital currency that runs on a global peer-to-peer network without the backing of any nation or any other central authority. The recent ascent has traditional...
It's fiat without... It's a fiat currency without the backing of a government, which is...
It's really scary when you think about
it. Market. Well, no, it's the essence. You call it scary because you're like a West Coast liberal. But I would say that well, I mean, that's what you are. I would say that it is the essence of the free market at play.
Lawrence White, an economist who teaches the history of banking and money at George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, says it's something of a mystery that Bitcoin has a positive value at all, since it wasn't launched in the way a new currency is typically launched. Typically, if a country wants to introduce a new currency, they make it redeemable for the old currency at a fixed exchange rate, and then after a while, they cut off the link and retire the old currency. But they launch the new currency by giving people a sort of firm expectation of what it's worth. Bitcoin didn't do that. It just launched itself by its own bootstraps, and we really don't understand how that worked as economists. Doesn't that scare you a little?
No, I think this guy is a relatively conservative economist, which is why he's like, we don't really know how that works, because he's not an economist. He's a conservative economist. And I would say that what Bitcoin has done is it's inspired confidence in people, and confidence is what the economy is all about. And it's shown that based on the idea that we can transfer value from one individual to another in a way that is not controlled or leveraged by a central economy of a governing nation is the essence of free market.
You know what this actually reminds me of?
That's simply what it is.
Interestingly enough,
Neuromancer.
One of the first things which I thought about when we discussed this is BitTorrents, actually. And just
that's in part what they're laying it out.
Right.
Yeah, that's exactly what they're laying out. It's not centralized. It's bit focused. You can say that BitTorrent reminds you of it. And I would say that the big thing here is that BitTorrent is measured by confidence. How many people are seeding this? If there are not enough people to seed it, it's not a confident torrent. You'll get comments to say so, and you will not try to download that. Bitcoin is the same way. It's saying that these people are behind it. That's why it's focused on how many computers, how much computing power we're sitting behind it. This is real, and I can redeem this. But the thing is, what gives it the confidence is the fact that people are not interested in trying to turn it back into money. They're trying to continue to put their money into it, knowing that it's a currency that allows them to get what they want. Because the thing about currency and purchasing power is that as an individual, you decide what you'd rather have. Would you rather have more currency, or would you rather spend that currency to get something in the real world, whether that currency is bank-based or Bitcoin-based? And I distinguish the two because Bitcoin is not a bank. Right. It's simply a manner of understanding value, and that to me is exciting.
I think like one of the aspects that people criticize Bitcoin for is because it's untraceable, essentially, that it can be used to purchase illicit items such as drugs and prostitution.
And that is part of the free market. I am sure that there are things going on that governments don't care about.
Sure.
But that is exactly why Bitcoin may be growing the way it is, because Bitcoin does not care about what governments care about. Because Bitcoin is not tied to governments. Uh-huh. It is just a free market. If you let the invisible hand manage the economy, we begin to see things. Things that are happening in our normal, conventional economic world, but that happen much faster on Bitcoin. For instance, I say that meaning Colorado, Washington State, California allow for medical marijuana. Why? Because the economy is moving that way. That's where people want to be. That's where the money is moving. But because of the legislatures, it takes forever for them to become legal, and then the decriminalization becomes hard to become legal, and the recreational use becomes hard to become illegal, etc. But with Bitcoin, it's like wherever the economy wants to go, it's going to go. The money's going to go there. If Bitcoin were around in 2008 when the first iPods went on sale on the gray market, we would have seen some amazing things happen. But we're seeing those amazing things happen anyway because we're sitting in front of a world that's got, you know, the ability to sell drugs, like you said.
You know what's interesting about what you just said, Dwayne, is that when you think about it, Bitcoin it's not the source of the problem as far as the illicit trade goes. It's a litmus test for how people want to spend that money. So it's basically like Bitcoin, the fact that Bitcoin is being spent in this manner it represents not the fact that Bitcoin is part of the illicit trade problem, but that there is an illicit trade going on, and this is how people choose to fund it. Like you're showing where the money is going to, whether it be Bitcoin or any other sort of currency.
Exactly. So that is the essence of a free market. People will follow what they want, and they'll fund it the best way possible without anyone else getting involved. When you hear right-wing people talk about government that isn't involved or small government, Bitcoin is what they really want to happen, except for the fact that there are actual people who don't, you know, who want some control over certain things. Bitcoin allows people to spend funds in ways that they want to spend funds without having oversight. Is it dangerous? Yes, the risk is high. The reason you have a government behind your money is because the government's going to regulate what you can spend money on legally. So you understand that your risk is mitigated. The banks work with the government, your money is in the banks, yada, 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 yada. Bitcoin, the risk is incredibly high because it could all fall apart at one moment. And if this new virtual currency falls under the same types of patterns that our current currency falls under and the way we use money in the monetary systems, then there'll be a bubble and it will explode. But at $1 billion, it's probably far – I'm not a stock person, so don't take my advice. But at $1 billion right now, it's probably far and away from where it will grow to. Will Bitcoin take off and become the standard? Unlikely. We found that with new ways of currency, people figure out to optimize, maximize in those ways that do not deter people from traditional monetary systems. So we can see some sort of hybrid before we see Bitcoin just becoming the way that we do things. But it is a lead indicator of how we can manage funds in the future and allow a free market to help to dictate what it is that we want and what we need. And there's something to that. It's an indicator, not a necessity. And that's a big part of what life is.
Plus, currently, security is really shit. Like, cloud-stored Bitcoin shared wallets get hacked, like, every so often, too often for stability.
And that's what we mean by there's lots of risk.
Yeah. Like, there was a report that one of those shared wallets got hacked today. I would not invest in any I wouldn't put my money in something that I thought could get it. It's like the Wild West where banks were getting robbed all the time.
But who are you? You are Andy Sorsini. You are a person who works a standard job in the Western world. But if you were a drug cartel owner, runner, and could put money in Bitcoin knowing that I could either get shot tomorrow or you could try to get the Bitcoin today.
Your
understanding of risk is very different.
Right. Also, it's probably chump change for them to lose whatever amounts they have in there in the big picture. Mm-hmm. You know what the other interesting thing about the Bitcoin phenomenon is? The identity of its creator remains one of the internet's great mysteries. There's a great little article in Business Insider I'm going to quote from a little bit here. It's widely agreed Bitcoin emanated from an individual calling himself Satoshi Nakamoto. Until his disappearance from the web around spring 2012, Nakamoto was a visible participant on cryptography forums where he discussed Bitcoin freely and published a 9-page paper outlining the details of the project. But there's near universal consensus that Satoshi Nakamoto doesn't exist. Instead, a worldwide guessing game has sprung up over who's behind the Nakamoto handle. In 2009, New Yorker's Joshua Davis set out to answer the question and may have come close. He narrowed it down to a man named Michael Clear, a grad student at Trinity College, Dublin, who's been named the school's top computer science student as an undergrad. He was hired by Allied Irish Banks to improve its currency trading software, and he co-authored an academic paper on peer-to-peer technology. He's well-versed in economics, cryptography, and peer-to-peer networks.
He's a ringer.
Well, he was.
Think about it. If you were the guy controlling or girl controlling $1 billion worth of bitcoins, you'd point yourself to that motherfucker too.
Yes. Well, he was the author of the New Yorker article. Joshua Davis forced Clear to say, "I'm not Nick Nakamoto, but even if I was, I wouldn't tell you." And he later denied that he was Nakamoto on the internet, and now there's no trace of that guy on the internet either.
This is one of the problems with the press, the way that they want to chase down. Like, it's like you're damned if you do, you're damned if you don't. You're trying to do something that's good for the world, and the press will chase you down and try to expose you, and then the negative externalities you have to deal with. This is what happened to that girl, Malala Yousaf, in Pakistan. She was a unknown, pseudonym blogger, and the press was like,
she's so good at explaining why women need to be part of education that they went out and they were like, we have to find out who she is. They found out who she is. They exposed who she is. The Taliban shot her in the head. And that ties into this kind of thing. The idea that, like, you have to worry about the press. It's a good thing the press is around. Don't get me wrong. I mean, we're part of the press too. But the investigative, journalistic press that's motivated by this idea that if I find out who this person is, I'll get my Pulitzer or whatever, or Peabody or whatever, that often gets in the way of the kind of changes you're trying to make. It's just interesting.
But don't you think it's weird that we've got a currency, a worldwide currency, has sprung up out of virtually nowhere, and we don't know who invented it? I think it's maybe just curiosity. It's curiosity.
But it's a movement, and a movement is born of more than one person. In the past, in the 20th century and before, we lived in a world that was so patronymically dominated that we needed to find a person to discern who led whatever. But this person has decided they don't want to be in those shoes. They don't want to be any kind of systemic or cause-based leader. They want to seed something and let it go where it must. And that is a paradigm that we have to begin to get used to in the early 21st century, that we're not used to from the 20th century. And that's one of the things that matters. We have to be able to realize that change is the only consistent thing and that this is the way the world is changing. There are people who want to be able to move others, ingest and inspire with new ideas that don't need to be the center of the attention. And it doesn't help the press out, because the press is like, I want a center of attention. I want to have a focus on them. I want to make them a celebrity. I want to make them a whatever. This is how it's been since the Bible showed up. But thankfully, it's changing from my perspective.
And I just want to wrap this up by saying that the author of the article for Business Insider did their own cursory search, and the consensus amongst the people he asked is that Nakamoto is actually a small group of developers from either New York or London who are deeply experienced software developers. And I think that that sounds more likely, that it could be not just one person, but a small group
of people. But a group of people.
Yeah.
We like to find one person to be like, oh, that person is what's up.
Yeah.
But the fact is that when it comes to massively wonderful new things in this world, it usually takes the marketplace of ideas and not some super inspiring individual. I mean, we're tied to it because even if you're not religious, there's this kind of Jesus complex that, like, it was him. It was that guy over there. It was Lincoln. It was Jesus. Right. It was whatever. And I think that today we're beginning to realize that we can collaborate in such ways that allow us to create a movement from a traditionally what we would call grassroots, from a group of people who just kind of believe in the same thing without needing to necessarily be completely associated with that thing as individuals. They don't exist by themselves.
Anonymous people?
Well, yeah, in some ways. A group
or
of
Spartacus?
People who are...
I'm Spartacus?
Yeah, exactly. A group of people who are like, we are a group. It's not about me. Which is a hard thing for our capitalist understanding to come to grips with. This idea that I'm not going to take control or I'm not going to do whatever, but perhaps I am good and my colleagues will realize that I am good, but together we realize that we're doing this as a group. And I'm not going to try to supersede that with my own ego. That's a hard thing for us to deal with coming out of the 20th century, when we were dominated by personalities between the two Roosevelts, the, you know, Ike, Khrushchev, Stalin, Hitler, these personalities that are like, it is about me. It's a hard thing for us to deal with. So I think that we need to look at it from a relatively new paradigm, which is an uncomfortable way to look at it, even for myself, who's kind of a super free market realist. That's just what I'm saying.
All right, moving on here. Constant close contact with your friends. That's the promise of a Facebook phone. The modified Android OS and mobile home screen replacement that sources say Facebook will unveil April 4th, which is tomorrow as we record this, but yesterday as you will be downloading this and hearing it, pushes your social... Yes. So it's a weird sort of time loop we're in where this event will occur in that gulf between when we recorded this and when you're hearing it. So this new Facebook OS will push your social life to you, so fetching it isn't interruptive. While it only takes a quarter of a minute each time, reaching for your phone, waking it from sleep, firing up the Facebook app, and loading your latest notifications does pull you out of the present. Checking your news feed for the latest photos and stories from your friends is a conscious decision. If the data is automatically fed right to your home screen, every time you open the phone, you'd be instantly up to date on conversations with friends and get a peek into their lives. And if Facebook can pipe this content into the lock screen, it'd be even more immersive, like a true heads-up display. That's the purpose of what Facebook plans to launch tomorrow as we record. It's a Facebookified home screen that will be shown off on an HTC handset running a version of Android modified by Facebook, similar to what...
Forked?
Yeah. Similar to what they did with the Kindle. Making Facebook an indigenous resident of your phone's home screen could accelerate your social life. It might reduce the time it takes you to respond to messages or continue a comment thread. If a friend's down the street, Facebook could have a better chance of advising you to join them. Giving Facebook a way to tell you more directly about what's going on in your immediate vicinity could be important as it focuses more on local discovery. Now, when I read this report, the first thing I thought about is this sounds like Google Now, which is an Android, currently an Android indigenous service as well. What do you think about this potential Facebook revelation?
So I don't know about such you guys, a thing.
Go ahead. Well, all I was going to ask is, do you think there's such a thing as Facebook oversaturation?
So I was going to say something similar. My phone does not receive Facebook notifications. I use an iPhone 5. I'm on iOS 6 point whatever. I don't get Facebook notifications. My iPad, however, is iOS. It's an iPad 3. It's an iOS 6 point whatever. And I haven't stopped the Facebook notifications because the battery is so big. Who gives a shit? And to be honest, I feel like when it comes to my iPad, it's almost as if it's a Facebook OS. Notifications are omnipresent. The way that my friends, family are able to communicate with me in real time, with me just like noticing when the screen lights up, that's huge. My girlfriend tags me. My girlfriend says something. I see it. It's all there. It works a little bit with Twitter, but just not as much because many of the more conventional people that I roll with are not on Facebook. I mean, not on Twitter, rather. While I see a Facebook forked version of Android working, I see people saying, okay, well, I'm native to Facebook. I like the fact that Facebook's native. I don't see it really dominating my world much more than it does on my iPad, which is an iOS device. Now, when it comes to the idea of Facebook allowing you to more simply and easily see who's around you to interact with them, I think this is actually a really positive thing, economically speaking. What I mean by that, pardon me, is that if I'm a local business, I'm a bar.
Yeah.
And, you know, Johnny Jimmy James is my best friend, and he's checked in at that bar on Facebook. And I noticed that more natively than I would any other way, because the Facebook OS is going to do that for me. And I go into that bar. Suddenly, I'm being notified that someone I care about is nearby. Let me go spend time with them. That's a story that Facebook wants to tell. And that's a story that bar wants to tell. Every bar wants to be cheers. Every bar, and that is to say, for younger people, every bar wants you to feel as if, you know, it's a place where everybody knows your name and that you're
right.
Welcome there. So the idea that Facebook can allow that kind of functionality, they can generate those sorts of interactions with individuals and attribute them to themselves, is something that local businesses, real world stuff, not just online social media, you know, yahoos like us are into, that's going to move the needle for them. That's going to make them a default. So I think there's something pretty special there. And if they can really pull that off in the way they're describing it, then more power to them. For me, I don't love Facebook enough to go for a mono platform. If anyone's ever seen Star Trek, they notice that like the Klingon Empire all seems to be the same kind of people. The Vulcan world and the Romulus world all seem to be the same kind of people.
Yeah.
I need something that allows me to be more of a federation with different types of people. And that's what I mean when it comes to apps.
You think that – let me stop you there for a second. You think that the people on Facebook all seem to be the same kind of people?
I think that the Facebook phone limits my ability to interact with other social networks. And as much as I think that Facebook has become the default social network, everything ties into it. It ties into everything. I know that the only consistent thing in the tech world is change, in the world in general. So I don't want to feel like as if I'm locked into Facebook. For me, Apple serves some things that I want now, and those things exist beyond Facebook, meaning if I take a picture while I'm visiting China or India like I did last year on my phone and I go back to my hotel and there's Wi-Fi, that picture is now on my computer. Facebook isn't going to allow me to do that in the same way, as neatly as Apple does right now. It's going to take years for them to figure that out or to make me feel as if they figured that out. And because of that, I'm not willing to move yet. Android pulls that off with Google Drive, Picasa, things like that. So, you know, there is an alternative if I want to move away from Apple. But Facebook won't be there for some time, and I'm not willing to move my life to Facebook for that. Now, are there younger people than me who are coming out of high school, college, middle school who want that functionality? Probably. And I think that's where Facebook has to work first. Just like cigarettes, hook them while they're young. I think that's a viable strategy. No, I mean, it sounds funny, but I actually, you know, I have no moral compunction there. Yeah. I think it's a viable strategy to get people to understand or to adopt their layout of what the world is. And Facebook is a relatively safe place. They've come out and said already that they're focused on making sure that inappropriate relationships don't happen. I'm a 33-year-old. If I suddenly start talking to some 16-year-old in a nasty way, they're going to let that 16-year-old's parents know if they can find their parents, that kind of thing, or maybe the cops or maybe whomever. That's the thing that makes me as a potential parent think, okay, a Facebook phone might be more powerful to me than a Kijit phone in terms of monitoring what my kids are doing and what's appropriate and what's not. That's huge.
All right. That was fairly extensive explanation. I appreciate that.
I'm sorry.
No. That's exactly why we have such great people on this show, is for that that really thorough explanation. Okay. So Apple. Moving on. Apple plans to begin production of a refreshed iPhone similar in size and shape to its current one in the second quarter of the year, according to people familiar with the device's production, teeing up a possible summer launch for the next version of the flagship device. At the same time, Apple continues to work with its manufacturing partners in Asia on a less expensive iPhone that could be launched as soon as the second half of the year. The 4-inch device will likely use a different casing from the higher-end iPhone. The two devices reflect new pressures on Apple. The company has long commanded unique premiums for the iPhone, but consumer demand for cheaper products is spiking. A flood of smartphone entrants and the rise of Samsung have commoditized the market, squeezing margins and dividing profits among an array of devices. So we're obviously talking about this would be the 5S, falling in line with Apple's typical release schedule, would it not?
Newly discovered typical release schedule. Let's just make sure we know that there was an iPhone, an iPhone 3G, an iPhone 3GS, and an iPhone 4, and then we just barely, in 2011, we realized that there was a 4S, that was a typical thing.
Mm-hmm.
Apple has been known to surprise us, to do things in new ways. The iPad 4 came out months after the iPad 3, not a year.
Mm-hmm.
So they might come out with... And we also know that the iPad 4, which is just called the new iPad.
Yeah.
I mean, the iPad 3 and the iPad 4 were both called the new iPad. Part of that was because they were making a different device, the iPad mini. And to have a number on one marketing end and to have a word on the other marketing end would cause confusion. So there's an iPad and there's a smaller version called the mini. If Apple is to develop a less expensive, more comely iPhone, then it may be that the numbers are over, that the 5S is not the word as much as there is the iPhone and, for lack of a better term, the iPhone cheapo. So I know it sounds terrible. I couldn't really think of something in the moment. But that's what I'm saying. Like, if they're going to have a high-end, low-end situation, then they may have to worry about that. Now, Samsung has figured out that there are Samsung phones,
yeah,
and then there's the Galaxy. And that is brilliant because you can get a Samsung phone, and you know that if it's not a Galaxy phone, meh. You know what I mean? Mm. Whereas the iPhone name is synonymous with high quality and the best possible thing. So Apple has to find a way to, if they are truly creating this thing, which is a rumor. They're truly creating a cheaper product, they have to find a way to make that cheaper product and not sully the iPhone name.
Yeah.
And that might mean ending this number and then estimate. Let's remember that the iPhone 5 is really the sixth iPhone. So these numbers don't mean a lot to it.
Right.
Yeah.
My question is really, how are they going to, with so many advancements and the competition that Samsung is giving them, how are they going to compete with this next iteration without, what are they going to release with this next iteration without feeling like they're treading old ground?
NFC is a big thing they can do. They can show a standardized version of NFC that lies into their passbook. They can work with the Starbucks type, individuals who have figured out how mobile payments work, and they can really endeavor, or maybe they can integrate with PayPal or Square to endeavor to do that properly. But the big problem they've had with the iPhone 5, from my perspective, is that it's had no significant software deviation.
Yeah.
From,
I knew you were going to say that.
From the iPhone 4S. I mean, it's a thing. Every other iPhone, everyone's complained, why can't my iPhone 3GS do whatever my iPhone 4 does when it comes to HDR? Why can't my iPhone 4 do the Siri thing that iPhone 4S can do, right? Like, there have been people who've been able to show that there's no hardware differences, but Apple's made software differences that's made that work. Now, people will say that when it comes to Siri, there's like a different like audio recognition chip, etc. But the fact is, between the iPhone 4S and the iPhone 5, there's been no significant change in the functionality for the user. The big difference is the screen size, the LTE, things like that. If Apple can figure out a way to significantly differentiate the 5S from the 5, maybe it's going to be battery length, battery life. Maybe it's going to be camera, significantly better camera. Maybe it's going to be something else. If they can pull that off, we'll get excited. But right now, maybe it's going to be the fact that the phone could be the same size but have a bigger screen because the technology's allowed them to lower the bezels on the top and the bottom. Who knows? Mm. Developers wouldn't enjoy that resolution situation, but people would be like, oh, it's even better. I mean, that's what Samsung did when it came to the Galaxy S4. Apple's got to find a way to show a device that is an S4 killer. I've said that.
And Sir Ives, we trust. I definitely see where you're coming from in terms of the refactor, and it sounds like that's what they're doing for iOS 7, but the question is, when is that going to hit the markets? Because from all extensive word is that, they're having to pull developers from other regions to get it done. It's taking too long. So we'll see what comes out in that realm. But
and what do we want from iOS 7, Tosin? Like, what, when you look at iOS 7, when you look at iOS 6, what to you is missing the most so that you feel like iOS 7 needs to have X or I'm going to leave? Or iOS 7 is not exciting, which is even worse because it's the banality of iOS.
Well, I think people have in general have just become comfortable with what the phone can do, and I think what you really need is something to make a splash. So kind of like Samsung said there, and not that I know it works well, but the ability to not even have to touch the device to do navigation, or the ability for it to change pages based off look. So new technology in there, anything like that really gives it a splash. I definitely agree that NFC is a long time coming, although Apple has tried to say that they're although Apple seems not ready to go that direction, but it seems less confident that
NFC is the direction in which it needs to go in order to enable mobile payments or other things.
Exactly, and that's one of those big differentials that you see Android users in their ability to flaunt it over iOS. They're like, oh, I want to share this photo. Oh, you're not running NFC. So I think that'd be a step in the right direction, but they just really have to do something innovative because Samsung has all the cards and is really taking the lead there.
They are. I completely agree. And I actually think that – I remember about a year ago when iOS 6 came out, I said, for me, iOS 7, I would love it if it had the ability to do the power nap situation when it came to apps. Automatic app uploading, app updating while I have it on sleep, on Wi-Fi, plugged in, whatever. That is simply not enough now. They need to blow me away.
Yeah.
They do.
Yeah.
I need to be blown away. I need to not look at a phone that has cheaper type metal than the last series of phones. Like the iPhone 5 has this aluminum on the sides, which anyone who's ever owned a black iPhone 5 knows causes scratching, loss of anodization, and these weird silver marks on the side of the phone that wasn't a problem on the iPhone 4 or 4S. And they need to show me that they're willing to be somewhat avant-garde instead of being safe. When the iPhone came out, it was avant-garde. We don't do half the shit that BlackBerry or Palm Trio does, but we look good and our interface is spectacular. That's what the iPhone first said to me. iPhone 3G said, you know what? We added 3G and we added GPS. And now the OS allows for apps. The iPhone 4 changed the game. I hate to use the phrase, but that's exactly what happened. Retina display, HDR photo, new programs, new apps, new everything. iOS 4 allowed a smart way to multitask. Brilliant. Right? iPhone 4S... all it had was Siri. We begin to see this downslope of what's innovative. It was the same thing with Siri. Yeah. iPhone 5, the screen is bigger. We're trying to catch up to the Android guys. The LTE, we're trying to catch up to the Android guys. Siri's here too, yay. But really, there was no big difference. Whereas Android has been jumping in leaps and bounds, despite the fact that we all know that Android started with some aspects of copying off of iOS. But it just goes to show that in technology, being first to market is not right. necessarily being best to market. And being fair means nothing in the face of consumer loyalty.
And you can't rest on your laurels.
That's exactly what it means.
All right. So this is our last headline of the evening. And it's a sad one. A sage pillar of the gaming industry has fallen. Just 154 days after acquiring LucasArts as part of its larger $4 billion acquisition of Lucasfilm, Disney has dissolved the classic video game development company. Beginning today, Disney will continue to license out the LucasArts properties, namely Star Wars, but has ceased the development of all internal projects. Some projects, such as the incredible-looking Star Wars 1313, may find new homes with other development houses, but the status is currently up in the air. While the move was not unforeseen, that doesn't make today's news any less disheartening. And the report in that I'm reading here from TechCrunch, but I share the sentiment, says a part of my childhood, a part of an entire generation of gamers' collective childhood really goes down with LucasArts. To the 150 people reportedly laid off today and to everyone who had part in Lucasfilm, LucasArts legacy, we thank you. And it lists some of the notable titles from the LucasArts legacy. The Monkey Island series, The World of Guybrush Threepwood. I don't know, do you guys remember Monkey Island?
Of course.
Yeah, so this guy's this – we don't even have to go on, but the bottom line is that like – when Disney bought, I'm going to say shame on you.
And full disclosure
I'm going to say it to you too, because when Disney got access to LucasArts, I lamented in front of you guys. And you guys were like, what do you mean? It'll be great. Stop worrying. This is the type of shit that happens when stuff changes hands.
Let's clarify. Well,
no, we're going to clarify.
And full disclosure
I'm going to have my piece, then you can have
full disclosure. Sure. I'm a Disney employee. But yes. I also don't. I mean,
you can't speak ill of Disney. It's like no. Toasting can't speak ill of Box. I can be critical.
I can be critical.
Well, I prefer you not because I want you to keep your job so Disney to produce this podcast. But what I'm saying is that when these things change hands, big business is so much more focused on the free market than the business that actually created. Like when Lucas created LucasArts, Lucas Games, all these things.
Yeah.
He has an emotional tie. The individual has an emotional tie. The people he brought up with him has an emotional tie. And to transfer that authority via an acquisition rather than hand it down means that we're going to lose something. And what we've lost, possibly, is these games. Now, if Disney's smart, the acquisition of Lucas can possibly end in, you know, farming off the game creation, monetization, and all the other things. So people like Activision or someone else. People with the coders and the talent and the interest to continue to build these properties.
The Star Wars titles are not going to go away. Those are going to continue to be developed.
Well, that's because every single movie to come out is going to have a game tied to it, which we're all going to lament, just like we did with The Phantom Menace in 1999 and that damned long pod racer scene.
It's the other ones that I feel sort of heartbroken about. Like the Maniac Mansion.
Guys, you got to think about it in terms of just follow the money.
Yeah.
And when
you think
about it that way, we are not, as people who are sentimental, going to be satisfied with how this ends up when it comes to things like the Grim Fandango.
Grim Fandango, Day of the Tentacle.
I mean, a clarification here. Yeah. I think, for one, I would have to say Andrew and I don't necessarily say we were more in line talking about Star Wars.
I'm going to find the tape, though, so don't. Hold on.
You can find the tape.
I'm going to find the tape. So
we were talking about Star Wars as a property and changing hands out of George Lucas's hands in terms of the Star Wars films. So that's the first thing. Now, I mean, one thing to really think about, though, when it comes to the properties we're mentioning, these are all really old properties. This is all nostalgia that we're waxing on about. And a lot of the individuals who are responsible for those are at other organizations creating similar types of games like Double Fine. So when you really actually – one of my friends and I had this discussion today and we were kind of like, well, what really has LucasArts made of late? And so I end up going to Wikipedia and organizing the titles. Mm-hmm. And we see that their rise in fame was mainly in the 90s. They still did some nifty projects like Lego Star Wars, but a lot of the recent – stuff hasn't been great or not as compelling.
90s, I'm gonna kill you.
Well, you know what I mean. A lot of the recent stuff is not really as compelling. And although I definitely, you know, I think it's sad news whenever a company closes, especially when individuals lose their jobs for it. I still have to believe that, you know, they weren't necessarily putting out hits at this juncture. And like you said, it is all about following the money. Yeah. And you clearly can see, you know, Disney already has their gaming division. There's no real need for them to further this. But I don't think this will necessarily have a huge negative reflection on what will occur with the new Star Wars movies.
Sure. No, that property will be protected as
but
far
what
as
games will become of the new Star Wars movies.
Well,
we see new Star Wars
movies
that are so focused
general
on games that we end up with like yucky.
Well,
movies.
No, here, it
unless
could.
I get X-Wing versus TIE Fighter again. I don't really.
Or
care
you could get that. Something like here's another scenario. Say that they license the Star Wars property to someone like Bethesda, and they create like a Skyrim but set in the Star Wars universe, where you're a Jedi Knight going around this huge Star Wars universe, fighting battles, and
that's what I just said. Like, if they like pass this on to people like Bethesda, to the big people who can make games and who are interested in making those games,
Rockstar,
Rockstar, don't do that. Don't do that.
Yeah, I mean, not Rockstar. I could not see Disney passing that Rockstar. That'd be hilarious, though. If they did,
it'd be hilarious. Awful. I just like,
Hey, Rockstar made the Warriors video game, which was amazing.
The Warriors was an amazing film.
Yes, it was.
I'm so, gonna stop there.
You know, the sad thing about this, though, there is that nostalgia factor, because they, beyond the Star Wars stuff, they did make some really good games. I'm going through the list here, and I'm looking at, like, the earliest games I remember playing are, there are two games called Ball Blazer and Escape from Fractalus.
So my girlfriend calls me the first two nights we were together.
Ball Blazer.
Oh, womp womp.
And those were games were on early Atari systems, like the Atari 800. And they're super, if you look at the video for them, they're super like low res, cheesy. But you know what? Those games were in a whole world for me. And Ball Blazer was essentially like a, the concept of that game was like soccer in hovercrafts, which is an amazing sort of concept. I'm looking at other games here like Afterlife, Day of the Tentacle, Escape from Monkey Island, Full Throttle, Grim Fandango we mentioned, Indiana Jones and the Fate of Atlantis was a terrific tie-in game, Loom, The Dig, Maniac Mansion.
I mean, Jedi, there were a lot of good
Jedi
titles.
Jedi Knight Dark Forces 2.
Sure.
Ever. No, don't say sure.
No, I'm saying yes. Obviously, yes. Where the like the Star Wars properties, there were some fantastic games in the Star Wars property. But I'm talking about even outside of the Star Wars properties, they had some terrific games as well. And I'm just going to miss sort of those things. And I don't think we'll ever see those non Star Wars properties again. Picked up by other.
That's why I keep a Windows 98 SE machine, yeah. Just like chilling to play those games.
Yeah.
And all of you should too. You can get a Shuttle 250. You can get a Pentium 4 and play Windows 98 SE games for the rest of your lives for about $300.
I like
or
that
you
idea.
Get an Ouya and then just format it.
You can, but it's running an ARM situation, not a Pentium situation.
I guess that's true.
Yeah, exactly. Guys, go out, find your Pentium 4 Northwood systems with your hyper-threading. Remember that? And get yourself some Lucas games, and you will not deny the fact that you're happy that I told you to do that.
So, closing off this week's episode, we have been doing a thing the last few weeks that we call Viral Video of the Week, where we present a video that's sort of bubbling up around the internet in the week. And this week, April Fool's Week, the White House announced on Monday that it would be releasing a special message from the president. And I'm not going to say any more beyond that. The link is there.
He's just so cute.
Yes, it ties into, I think, the very first viral video that we ever did on the show here. Definitely check that out. And I think that's it for this week. Except to go around the table here and starting with you, Dwayne. Where can we find your work on the internet when you're not here on the Drill Down?
You can find me on twitter.com/DwayneD. You can also find me at flavors.me/DwayneD. It's where basically a lot of my stuff sits. And I am writing lots of stuff for Clip Interactive, this new startup that is focused on connecting radio broadcasts with digital. And you can find that at blog.clipinteractive.com.
Nice.
Which is incredibly hard to write out. So if you're lucky, you'll end up there.
And Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online?
You can find me on twitter.com/toast, T-O-A-S-T, 4321. You can also find me talking about random stuff and actually listen to our latest PAX prank at the ircwebcast.blogspot.com.
As for myself, you can find me at twitter.com/MrBabyMan and facebook.com/MrBabyMan. I occasionally write for Geeks of Doom. And you can find my stories by just searching for Mr. Baby Man on Geeks of Doom. You can check out the past episodes of The Drill Down as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network by going to geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Our iTunes link is on the right-hand sidebar at geeksofdoom.com. Our show is on Stitcher. You can listen to us on your iPhone, Android phone, Kindle Fire, and other devices. Go to stitcher.com for that and just look for The Drill Down. Facebook.com/TheDrillDown, Twitter.com/TheDrillDown,
If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you got a viewpoint on any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. We published quite a few of those submitted stories so far, and we're getting more every day. Let the Drill Down podcast help you reach a targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers that is our audience by writing to us at sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.